Or maybe the Dharma and consumerism. But I thought I've been considering the culture we live in and how it cultures us, because we're not separate from it, although we like to think that, you know, it's a consumer society and I'm sort of not. There's always sort of that separation that we like to put in there between us and it. But we're pretty embedded in our culture, our society, and our relationship to consuming as a practice is part of right livelihood, actually. And so it's directly on the Eightfold Path and part of the Buddhist path of awakening. And so being aware of our consumer habits and the way we relate to our consumer society is part of the practice. There's a little haiku that was written by a guy named David Loy. Anybody know him? David Loy, as interpreted by Santokaro Bhikkhu. So I assume David wrote it, and I'm not quite sure what Santokaro did. But it's a haiku. The meaning of my life: buying and owning things, then throwing them away. Anybody not there? I mean, it's amazing, because we're so embedded in this culture, which is this culture distills our naturally occurring greed and longing, and distills it into a form of economy, and it creates some very deep habits in us. Anybody here not like bargains? You know, I mean, did bargains exist as bargains, you know, over history? Really? Getting the most and paying the least. You know, and we are, anybody just, you know, leap onto the internet and order the first one of whatever it is you see? No, we shop. You know, we like to compare, or we do. And it cultures our psychology. You know, we become. Well, anybody here have on their person right now at this point anything that they've made from natural sources? No. The basic necessities of our life are things that we buying and own and then throw away. And it's so deeply interconnected. I came across this, I think, so I copied it some time ago from a book, and I don't know what the book was, because all it says is introduction at the top. But we're embedded in it. It's global. And this is, so what exactly does this global consumption look like on the ground? Let's take an example that illustrates the far-reaching impacts of North American consumption. Coffee. Say the average person drinks 2 cups a day. A year's worth of coffee is about 18 pounds of beans per year, which require 12 coffee trees along with 11 pounds of fertilizer and pesticides. In the processing, 40 pounds of coffee pulp are released into rivers, consuming life-supporting oxygen as they decompose. The beans travel to the United States and are roasted using natural gas. After being packed in multi-layer bags, they are shipped by trucks, getting 6 miles to the gallon, to a regional warehouse. Coffee is the second leading export crop in the world after oil. and is the second largest source of foreign income for developing nations. In the cool highlands of Costa Rica, Brazil, and Colombia, thousands of acres of biologically rich tropical forest have been cleared to support the North American boom in espresso shops. I didn't read that to condemn what's going on. It's just, look at how deeply we're embedded in all of these processes. You know, our interconnection is, although this culture enculturates us to think of ourselves as individuals, we all are individuals, right? Unique, and we're individuals. If I said, how many individuals are there? All the hands would go up. And as individuals, we're engaged in the world, but we don't see how the tendrils go into everything. Coffee, but I like to think sometimes there's a great George Orwell line. We sleep soundly in our beds because harsh men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would harm us. We don't engage in violence, but we sort of outsource it, you know, to create an environment. So we're so embedded in this culture, we almost don't see it. It's like fish in water. We just take for granted. I was thinking about, we were talking about buying a new car. Henry Ford used to say, you can have whatever color you want as long as it's black. You know, now everything is customized. And customized to an extent, and personalized to an extent that, I mean, we almost don't notice it now, but I think of it as ego casting. You know, we just listen to the music we want to listen to. We go to the websites we want to see. Anybody here hang out at redstate.com a lot? Probably not, you know. We are embedded. We don't notice the fact that we are constructing a world that suits us. Acquiring things is not a path of awakening. Just to clarify, when we and yet we spend our time doing that. We don't. I mean, as an economy, we consume more than we produce. We purchase because we don't make so much ourselves, really. I mean, look at, you know, we don't make our clothes. We don't, and this is relatively recent historically, but we don't even notice it. What we make is money. You know, it's an abstract. I mean, it's very abstract, but it becomes a large part of the way we relate to the world and our experience. And we purchase a good time. You know, food, tasty, fun. Interesting. I mean, there are people who are into food and will spend a lot of time making it, but I sort of go out. And, you know, I watch my kids and they entertain at coffee shops or, you know. We consume our information. And our knowledge, we consume our experience, travel. Travel's, you know, it's not adventure. Adventure sort of implies the possibility of failure. You know, then there's something on the line. But we can have, you know, a Mexican adventure. I guess maybe you could. a Hawaiian adventure. We market things to distill that longing in us that is naturally there, but we distill it and condense it, that wanting. There is this, you know, the heart of dukkha is a sense of lack. We're missing something, not complete, not enough. And in this culture, the idea is generally you can fill that sense of lack with buying stuff, you know. We customize our identities and encrust ourselves in a collection of artifacts that reflect and create who we are. You know, do we drive? Anybody here driving a Hummer? We have a different identity. You know, but there are scenes where that's not uncommon. We clothe ourselves in our identities and display them. I think of travel as something that we consume. There's a George, and I thought of this because this past week I was reacquainted with an old George Harrison song. It was actually a Beatles song. Didn't get a lot of play because it was the flip side of the Lady Madonna 45. If you can remember 45s, I'm sorry.
45 what? Yeah.
I guess today would be a Colt 45. It's called The Inner Light, and the language is, without going out of your door, you can know all things of earth. Without looking out of your window, you can know the ways of heaven. The farther one travels, the less one knows. Not particularly a contentment is not a virtue. Anybody, you know, it's almost not even publicly acknowledged as a goal of life. I understand, although I don't follow Thai politics real closely, but I understand that in the past decade or so, there's been a real push towards consciously changing the notion about contentment. And contentment shouldn't be a goal of social life because it doesn't spur the economy. So we consume, we buy and own things and then throw them away. This is really part of right livelihood. Right livelihood, as the Buddha explained, he was talking about a different time. You know, it was there weren't managers of Safeway then. You know, and people were much more directly related to sustaining their lives, and we relate more abstractly through money. So there's the monastic standard. The monastic standard is the four requisites: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. And then we've got entertainment, and you know, we've got a whole bunch of other things. But we create our lives in such a diverse manner. We actually finance a lifestyle, is what our livelihood is like. We basically make money And then we assemble a lifestyle out of the cultural elements that are present. And you know, because we're so embedded in so much, it's very difficult to say. I mean, the Buddha said right livelihood, he hardly talked about it at all. I don't think I've heard a Dharma talk on right livelihood. Five things you shouldn't do, and you know, one of them is trading in weapons, trading in poisons, trading in living beings. I mean, if you manage a Safeway, oh, trading in meat. You know, if you manage a Safeway, you fall under all categories pretty much. You know, so we have to have a different standard. But right livelihood is part of our relationship to our consumer culture and our consumer habits, our own tendencies. And how do we make the decisions? And well, interestingly, it's not that there's something wrong with consuming. You know, it's not. And the Buddha never. In fact, he was clear that enjoying one's wealth is not a hindrance on the spiritual path. But one of the things that we do is we're looking for, you know, what the Buddha calls gratification. You know, that hit of satisfaction. You know, and we occasionally get it. He said, if we weren't getting that hit, some we'd give up. We'd go do something else. You know, if you want to get pigeons in a lab or rats in a lab to do something, you reward them randomly. And not fully, not right. Anybody, not what you do. So you maybe a 25% payoff randomly administered. Well, that's what happens to gamblers, you know. And in a sense, we're all sort of gamblers in this business of chasing satisfaction, chasing pleasant experience. Bhikkhu Bodhi likes to say, we spend our lives chasing pleasant experience, avoiding unpleasant experience, and figuring out how all this just relates to me. You know. And so it's not like there's never a payoff. There is a payoff. And we can spend a lot of time for that hit. And so we attempt to culture an identity and a life out of the elements out of the elements in the culture that we find ourselves. And it can get very ephemeral, even if mundane. Anybody ever thumb through a catalog looking for something? You know, is desire to, we're desiring to have something to desire. Yeah, we're just looking for a target for it. Yeah. And we don't even notice. It's just such a natural part of the way we live. We assemble a lifestyle. You know, with a right lifestyle, that seems pretty grim, but as a concept. But in a way, really, it makes more sense than right livelihood, because you know if you're a clerk, if you're a clerk, does it matter whether you work for Halliburton or the Sierra Club? You know, and then we're left with the fact that we're embedded so deeply in the culture and events around us that, you know, we don't go out and hunt our own food, but we outsource it. And so the way we make our money is one thing, and the lifestyle we create. And we can actually overextend and create a lifestyle that puts stress on our on the creating side. You know, in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says, "Unburdened with duties and frugal in our ways." And the idea is, I mean, we can not be unburdened. Jimmy Fallon is a nighttime talk show guy. I heard him on Fresh Air, and he was being interviewed. I don't think I'd recognize him, but he was asked, "Well, what do you do, you know, besides your work?" And he said, "Nothing." He can't even, if he wants to play a video game, he has to schedule it in. And from 6 to 6:30 on Thursday, I will play video games. He said, "But then, you know, my wife wants some attention, so much for the schedule." But you can be so, and you know, and the payoff is that for his vacation, he probably gets to go to a pretty exotic cabana somewhere in the South Pacific where nobody can reach him, you know, for a week. But you can put so much stress on your from your lifestyle, on your means of making a living, that we wind up overburdened. And of course, the culture convinces us that we are what we engage in. You know, and of course, the way out is not to purchase your way out. You can't, you know, even though some will buy little statues and stuff to try to enhance our spiritual experience. But the way out is through the cultivation of contentment. And contentment, in a way, is, I mean, in a real way, is the deepest dharma. You know, not all teachers agree, but I have sat with scholars who say Nibbana is upekkha. Bhikkhu Bodhi disagrees, and so does Tanjef of the monastics do. But equanimity is Nibbana. Equanimity contentment, deep contentment. Equanimity means engaging, being able to engage whatever arises without aversion or clinging. And equanimity, we try to culture equanimity ourselves in our practice, you know, through our Brahma-Vihara practices, for example. But true equanimity is unconditioned, which is interesting because that's what they say about Nibbana. It's unconditioned. It means that if you're equanimous, except when, you know, so-and-so comes in the room or shows up on TV, I'm equanimous as long as they keep, you know, that's not really equanimity, you know. Equanimity is unconditioned. And contentment, deepest contentment, would be equanimity. And that really undercuts all of our cultural habits. Contentment. I mean, if they make contentment, can advertise contentment? Be content. it's not something you can market. Even if people want it, it's sort of like, well, there are a bunch of different words that are used to describe the goal of our practice. You know, peace. But usually that means, I always think of Richard Nixon, peace with honor. Once everything gets cleaned up, then peace. Once I get what I want. I mean, true peace, of course. Peace in the presence of whatever trials or joys. Sounds good to me. But usually there's, you know, happiness is described. I think, isn't Thich Nhat Hanh talk about happiness as a goal, as, you know, but, you know, it can be understood as happiness versus unhappiness. Or it could be understood, in which case it's just another arising state. But true happiness isn't dependent on conditions. It can't be dependent on external sources, because if it's dependent on conditions, well then it's easy to lose. You know, it's not. And freedom is another one of these words that's used to describe sound. And again, it sounds good. I mean, freedom from slavery to the craving that arises and the aversion that arises, that they don't, or they don't, or we don't take the ball and run with it when they show up. You know. Freedom from our wanting and our fear. So the way out is not, you can't buy your way out. My wife and my dearest friend, who died some years ago, was a conscious consumer. And when she was dying of cancer, she spent money in an effort to try to make herself feel better. She bought cars and ping pong tables and fireworks. I mean, just amazing as a strategy for trying to deal with unpleasant realities. I was talking in the precepts class this morning. I think that's one of the targets of the third precept, the third precept is usually translated as to, for the purposes of practice, I'll refrain from sexual misconduct. But the Pali word is kamesu mechachar, so it's really about sensual misconduct. And our culture, of course, encourages sensual misconduct. But an effort to buy your way out of, or consume your way out of, indulge your way out of dissatisfaction. And it's a strategy that's hyped, rather than equanimity, or even equanimity, even with dukkha, even with the dissatisfaction, contentment with old age, sickness, and death. It's tougher, it's not quite as consoling. but equanimity would embrace whatever is present. Cultivating awakening in the midst of consumer culture means first recognizing that we're embedded, and that our own, you know, our unique, individual, personal, intimate psychologies are cultured in an environment where satisfying wants is really encouraged, you know. But, and it's encouraged by presenting happy people using products. You know, the only happy people the people who are unfailingly bright and happy are the people in commercials. They are, you know. As the it always makes me laugh. I have the TV on while I cook, and I'm usually cooking while the news is on. My God, it's drugs, you know. And I, you know, look over there every once in a while, and there are all these happy people, while the voiceover is talking about, you know, side effects that could include death. I sort of wonder. But the people on the screen are happy. You know? So trying to relate. So the first thing is to acknowledge our embeddedness, and which tends to make us think of ourselves as being separate. You know, even it's very deep individualism. I have a friend whose background, he came from India. And he said, "What's a really challenging in his relationship? He married someone who's American. He says at a really deep level, she sees herself as an individual, but he sees himself as primarily a member of a unit, of a social unit. And it's very different from the way we see ourselves. Yeah, so even at a very deep level." The nature of our culture, and you're not complete if you aren't wearing whatever or dressed like Lady Gaga. I enjoy her. She's really funny. So the Dharma practices, they're conventional Dharma practices that help dana, which is usually translated as generosity, but actually means giving, undercuts our consumer. And it's not that it undercuts it. Dana is the Pali word for giving, and the word for generosity is different. It's chaga. And so we practice giving in order to cultivate generosity, because the openness and generous heart really is what we're working for. But sometimes, you know, you have to. It's hard to work on our internal stuff. Anybody noticed? You know. So one of the ways is to set up a behavioral practice, and so dana can be that, and it certainly undercuts consumerism, and sila as well, the ethical practices, because they restrain the intention is to, because of the resolve one makes in regard to the precepts, or just to abandon the impulses which lead to, or which are come from delusion, the delusion that we can make ourselves happy by getting what we want. A sila is a renunciation practice. The precepts are renunciation practices. Sitting on a cushion is a renunciation practice. Because we the word renounce makes me sort of feel there's a Christian thing in there. Renouncing the devil, for me anyway, there's this pushing away. And it's not so much pushing away. It's abandoning. It's just not taking it up. You know, not getting sucked in. And these are insight practices in a very important sense, because when you resolve, for example, not to what's not freely given, if you actually resolve to do that, or make it, make any particular resolution. I resolve not to speak disparagingly of others. It's a form of right speech. If you actually resolve to do that, what do? When all your friends are gleefully talking about Paul Revere? You know, there's been some question about what actually happened. See, I can't control myself. But I do it through sort of obliquely. Yeah. Don't disparage. What is that line in the Metta Sutta? About don't despise any being in any state. So you can get away with it if you're really subtle. But
what happens if the state is Arizona?
I'm sorry?
What happens if the state is Arizona?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. I still owe Arizona some money for speeding. They took pictures of me in my car and then sent me a letter saying I'd sped. That was quite a while ago. Yeah, what if the state is Arizona? So the traditional Dharma practices, you know, Dana, Sila, these are practices of, in a way, renunciation, practicing letting go, and not clinging. As I say, they're insight practices because the idea is to make that resolve and then carry it out. And boy, what you've come up against is the impulses that arise that you've decided you're not going to, you know, act out on, like Paul Revere. Sometimes renunciation, I think it's Joseph Goldstein, says he prefers the term non-addiction. Now, freeing ourselves from addiction, non-addiction. Because the consumer habit is really almost, I mean, it's try not to. Just try to restrain by selecting a particular food or a particular goodie or an entertainment program or a habit. Just say, okay, here's one. It doesn't have to have any moral thing behind it. Just to say, I'm not going to do this for a day or a week or whatever and see what happens. And what happens is the impulse arises. My gosh. And the insight becomes possible because, like when you're sitting, you know, what shows up are your thoughts, you know, and what shows up will be the impulses to consume. It really is a huge part of our and comparing and shopping and. I mean, try to walk around without a credit card or cash. You know? We are just totally embedded in this. And you can see that if you were to resolve, really to resolve. And I make a distinction between, I was talking about this in the precepts class this morning too, the difference between wishing and resolving. And sometimes it's not so clear, but I wish I could lose weight. I wish I could quit smoking. I wish I could practice every day. You know? Well, you can practice every, you could resolve to sit every day. My wife had a practice before she became ill. She had a practice. She sat twice a day, 45 minutes every day, our daughter's wedding day. It was a, you know, it was a family legend. It didn't matter. She would, I mean, because that was the resolve. You can wish to lose weight. I wish I didn't want this cake. You know, we've all been there. I wish I could control my spending, so I'm controlling it by, I'm not doing one click anymore on Amazon. You know, I mean, and because there is a little a reward. It's like a treat, you know, because we get that little reward, that gratification. We keep coming back. The Buddha said there's a danger with the gratification. That is that at a certain point it won't pay off. Or, you know, the pleasant situation, you know, that you cultivated for quite some time can evaporate in the breath of a tornado. Oh my gosh. Unanticipated, you know, and that that's the danger of being sort of unconsciously driven by our longings and fears and aversions. You know, it's not a matter of right or wrong. It's just that it leads to our own suffering. And of course, the Buddha talked about the gratification, the danger, and the escape. And the escape was, well, it's abandoning. And the Four Noble Truths, each of the truths has a particular task that's associated with it. The Four Truths are one truth, one insight. It's the only insight that the Buddha was concerned about. It was the insight into the nature of suffering. This is the nature of suffering. This is the origin. This is the cessation. If you understood dukkha, if you understood suffering fully, if you really understood it fully, you would know what conditions give rise to it and what conditions lead to its cessation. So all the first three are all the same, and the fourth is the fourth noble truth, the path. Is the description of the way an awakened being would live. And we can cultivate that. That's why it's described as the path. It's to be cultivated. The first truth, the nature of dukkha, that dissatisfaction comes with the territory. If you are interested in satisfaction, you're going to be dissatisfied. You know? And that truth is to be understood. The second truth is the truth of the origin of dissatisfaction, and it's a particular kind of wanting. You know, like Eskimos have 39 different words for snow. You know, in Pali there are 20-something different words for desire. We just translate as desire. So tanha is a particular kind of desire, craving, wanting. It comes, we don't feel like we have a choice. You know, it's thirst. It translates to thirst. We feel that wanting the way we physically feel a thirst, a longing. And that's to be abandoned. That's the task associated. The third is the truth of cessation. And the word is actually nirodha, which means cessation. And it's different than nibbana, which is complete unconditioned. It doesn't depend on conditions. Nibbana, once nibbana is realized, it's like seeing the earth from space. It's pretty hard to talk somebody back into thinking that the earth is flat. You know, once you see, you know, and once you see the origin of your dissatisfaction and the nature of your dissatisfaction, you know, the realization of the third precept, or the third truth, then you would be free. And the path is also the goal. So it's a sort of a fake it till you make it kind of thing. You know? You know? I think the element that I was saying this morning earlier, it's like, you know, you have a basketball. Basketball is a sphere. It's brown. It weighs, I don't know, it's filled with air. You know, it's made of rubber. That's the eightfold path of the basketball. You don't just say, I'll take the brown part and leave out the, you know, you get it, it all comes at once. And the eightfold path all comes at once. It's all one path. And it just has different elements. And that's the understanding element and intention. Ethical speech, action, and livelihood, and then the effort to practice mindful, stable mindfulness. All one element. So the abandonment of our craving for and the delusion. You know, the delusion that we'll make ourselves happy, that my poor friend Anne, you know, the Ford Explorer that she bought didn't make her feel better for very long. So the trick is acknowledging that we're embedded in, you know, in this craziness, and then being willing to refrain being willing to do it, not just wishing you could. So resolving to practice, you know, with the elements of our culture, which means, you know, on NPR they were talking about kids spend more time connected to the to media than they, if they measure in hours, than they're awake. Because of multitasking, they're on the phone, they're on the computer, they got the, you know, so, I mean, we're just so embedded we don't notice. And one of the things I do like about Lady Gaga, she said, she's willing to say talk about anything she does. And she said, well, the private place is inside, it can't, you know, it can't be, it's accessible just to her. And that's the place where we need to attend. And yet the show, the cultural show, the, you know, the news comes not only with, and we consume our attitudes. We adopt the attitudes in the culture around us. It comes not only with a description of what happened, but how we should feel about it. You know. The default in our practice is to stay still and to stay silent. The Buddha really didn't ask much of the world except that he understand it. And so our task, that's our task. I think of some, you know, small renunciation practices that we can do to help us highlight that. And you can just pick a particular food, you know, take something and just try it for a bit. But a particular food that you, it doesn't even have to be something you like. It can be the sandwich that you buy every day at lunch, you know, and just refrain for purposes of practice, undertake the training of not buying Altoids. For me, that would be tough. I munch them as I drive, and I drive a lot. But it would be that kind of a thing. Or entertainment. You know, just the habits that we have adopted, because habitual behavior. You know, we become attached. And the problem was, there, although there's gratification, there's danger. And the escape is freedom. Please.
You know, I never really thought there was much to Lent. Lent was...
Absolutely, yes.
I always thought Lent was kind of a lost sort of concept. But as you describe it, if you can simply be mindful of the whatever it is that you think you're going to give up, that I can kind of get a better sense of it, although it also seems a little easier to just say, okay, that's it for chocolate, no chocolate today.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, well, let's see. Okay, I could deal with that. Try something, I don't know, whatever else, I'm not thinking of something, tea.
Sure.
I would have a hard time going all day without tea.
Uh-huh.
And I would really need to be mindful of that impulse. But I must say that I think I like the idea better as you described coffee. What does it take to bring that cup of coffee to me? And so I think I like kind of becoming mindful in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or in that fuller way.
Sure, absolutely.
Rather than just, I'm going to eat it, I'm not going to eat it, what kind of craving does it bring up
uh-huh.
in me? I think I like that fuller sense of mindfulness.
Well, right understanding means, as I understand it, so of course it's right understanding. It's about seeing things as they are, clearly, without delusion. That doesn't mean pretending everything is all the same or to gloss it all, but to look with some discrimination and keep track of the conceptual stuff that we come up with and our reactivity to it. And I think understanding, I love the idea of Lent. Never practiced it, but you're just, when I, you know, I used I have friends who give up things for Lent. But it is a renunciation practice, and can serve as a mindfulness practice. Yeah.
I think the opportunity for renunciation is fast approaching for the whole planet. I mean, with due respect, a lot of what you said, or most of what you said, we already know.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we've got a vast population, and a vastly increasing population on a finite planet. So,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Western culture has been exported to the East. And they're the people with the money and the growing appetite for that culture.
Yeah, so it's not just exported, it's also...
Yeah, so I mean, 2.5 billion Chinese and Indians who want to buy the mm-hmm. stuff that we have is clearly not going to last very long.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the crisis is coming and the opportunity to renounce will arise. And then, you know, then we'll, as a planet, fully understand what dukkha is.
Mm. Well, the question then is, how should we live now?
It's too late.
How should we? No, I'm not talking about saving the planet. I'm talking about how should we conduct ourselves.
See, people don't like to hear it's too late, but I mean, it really is.
Well, but too late for what? Too late in terms, it's never, it's always the present.
Right.
And the question is, what will we do in this moment? How
okay.
will we live in this moment? With whatever vision of the future we have, how should we conduct ourselves? How should we be in relation to the rest of us in this room and the people we're going to spend the rest of the day with? You know, before, and renunciation doesn't, you know, it's... or freedom, are things that we experience, we can experience. And we can chase after what we want, which is what everybody on the planet's doing, what we've always done. It's that our culture has just distilled that and made it really, you know, the Buddha didn't have hedge fund managers. You know, he wasn't addressing hedge fund managers. Or even simple technology. I remember Ken Wilber, somebody asked him, you're so smart, what do you know that the Buddha didn't know? And he said, how to drive a Jeep.
I really appreciated your speaking about contentment this morning. I just recently had the opportunity to spend 2 weeks in Paris with a fiery daughter, and Paris alone is fiery. And at one point in time, she looked at me and she said, "Ma, why are you so effing calm?" And, you know, I sort of thought for a minute. I mean, we're in the middle of the metro, and you know, people are like this, all around me. And I was like, because I sit. And I get tired of watching my thoughts, and I get tired of thinking those thoughts. And so in my practice, you know, I'm getting a little bit clearer, a little bit calmer. And it was quite an interesting moment because, you know, she really looked at me as though I was like half out of my mind.
You weren't in touch.
I was not in touch. I journeyed from there to Seattle and had the same experience with another member of my family, you know, who was sort of standing back and going, "What's Mom on? You know, she's so calm. And she's content, and she's not asking for anything." And you know, it was so interesting for me to see that, and to a certain extent to feel lonely in that place, but understanding what that loneliness was referring to, you know, and that was that I was not part of the codependent family relationship anymore. I had actually found a place in myself. It was truly...
It's more like solitude than loneliness.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
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 But, very, really, really interesting to take that out into the world and not just around spirit world.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
So, the idea of sort of being separate from the consumer culture and thinking, but then how... So then you have this feeling of separateness, but then there's such a longing for connection. So how do you deal with that?
I think that trying to be separate is, it's not possible to be separate. Mm-hmm. We can't be separate. It's not just the culture we're embedded in. We're embedded, it's the fact that all things are conditioned by all things. We depend on the biosphere, which depends on the planet's relationship to the sun and the sun to the galaxy and the galaxy to the Big Bang. We're dependent on the Big Bang. You know, so it's not a matter of being separate. That would just be a conceptual trick that we might perform. Because we're not. The issue is to notice the ways in which we relate. Because what happens is we relate in an unskillful way and we suffer. And we suffer because we aren't noticing that. You know, the desire for connection, you know, there's that longing again. And the first noble truth is if you're looking for satisfaction is an issue, you're going to be dissatisfied. It comes with the territory. Not that there won't be a payoff now and then. There will be a connection now and then. You know? And that's the addiction pattern. You know? So again, the idea is to pay attention to that. What is that longing like? How does it feel in the body? What are the stories that are going along with it that feed it? if only I, you know, loneliness were gone, then I wouldn't lack. There's that lacking feeling. And the lacking feeling is the feeling of dukkha. In this culture, we come to think of it, you know, something that we can purchase, the whatever it needs to fill that hole. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's natural to want to feel separate from such a rotten society. It's such a rotten society. I don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah, but you're reacting to it, so you're totally engaged.
But you are. And so you seek to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And by understanding it, you can fend off the negative influences.
Even more deeply, if you understand it, you will have compassion for all beings who are involved
in
it.
Even the capitalists.
Even ourselves. Even ourselves. You know, compassion for ourselves who are suffering in this setting, yeah.
So I had an interesting challenge this weekend. I was back in New Hampshire. I have a niece who participated in the state Special Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of Special Olympics. I donated to them for a long time. It's the first time I've actually gotten to see it. But I noticed every single volunteer had a Coca-Cola label on the logo on the back of their shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And the only food available at the site was fast food, which I do have an aversion to.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I could stay contented with, I'm just not going to eat that, so
yeah.
We're going to walk 6 blocks off campus into town to get real food instead of food-like substances. But it's also terribly distressing to me to see how much out of the mainstream I am, and especially kids that are already so challenged to be making them sicker intentionally. That it's a really, really tough one for me.
It's tough because we think it shouldn't be that way. Instead of just engaging in the pain that comes with the fact that it is that way, and then working from there. You know, the judgment is its own source of suffering, or its own suffering. You know? And there's...
Can you deepen that just a little bit?
About the judgment?
Well, it's...
Because the Special Olympics are financed by Coca-Cola in exchange for displaying their logo. So they're out there in left field when you go see the Giants, they are part of our culture. And they finance, I mean, you look at the French Open and there's labels, all you go to a little league field, there's local, I mean, that's what we do. That's how you become, and that's the way it is. And our aversion to it doesn't change that, it just adds our aversion to it. And we may not be able to do anything about it, like we can't do anything about the weather. But our judgment and our aversion are our own suffering. And that doesn't mean that the sadness isn't appropriate. It is sad. And it is. Way in the back, and yeah.
Before you started talking about how, you know, Coke is financing, I mean, for me, what I look at is, I really try to look at it as the struggle between good, you know, sort of, well, Coke, there's a lot of stuff that people, you know, they find aversion to, and they give a lot of money to some wonderful causes that allow for some wonderful things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm in that situation, that's what I try to bring up. I try to bring up what they are doing that I'm not averse to, and balance out the two things.
Well, it's recognizing it's the best of times, it's the worst of times.
And that there are, you know, the that they have that capacity where a lot of other people, better food producers, whatever, would not have that capacity to sponsor the Special Olympics or to do.
Yeah, the hedge fund guys aren't out there.
Right. So, that's how I do it.
Yeah. Well, it's the cup half empty, cup half full, and I like to think that the cup is just too big.
Another question: how do you sort of, you know, you have this sadness, but then there's also a sense of, well, I'm smarter, or a smugness.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. That, well, I can see things that.
Just notice that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's overcoming a fear of a sense of I'm not enough.